What do Shopify, Mercury, and Grubhub all have in common? Give up? Well, they keep coming back to me to enroll more of their designers in Figma Academy because it goes beyond the basics and teaches you advanced tactics that you can use to become more valuable to your team. We have weekly live sessions where we really get into the details of things like system strategies, workflows for speed, advanced prototyping, and I even give personalized feedback on all of your work throughout the program. So if you want to take your craft to the next level, I have a special offer for the listeners of this show, and I think you're going to like it. So head to dive.club/Figma to claim your spot. Okay, now on to the episode.
I think a lot of the like best practice for a design team is like the team should behave as one. There should be this very cohesive design system. Everyone should be producing work that is extremely consistent, that looks the same, that feels the same, that has the same voice. And I don't know whether that's right or wrong, but I know I've really enjoyed being in a team that kind of bucks that trend. We've kind of wound up in this place where it's like, no, everyone does have a fingerprint. I can look at something that anyone on the team has created and kind of know who made it without even being told. Like, I can just tell.
Welcome to Dive Club. My name is Rid, and this is where designers never stop learning. One of my favorite products that has launched in the last 5 years is Arc from the Browser Company. And today we get to hear from their founding designer, Nate Parrott. So this episode is a deep dive into what makes design at the Browser Company so special. We get into their culture of prototyping, how they explore new ideas. But first, we gotta get to know Nate just a little bit, because prior to joining the Browser Company, he had never held the role of designer before. So this story actually starts at Snap.
It was really fun. I really enjoyed it and was really torn about leaving. I joined as an iOS engineer right out of school, and I was on the SnapMap team, which is this kind of separate team out in New York that works on, you know, if you haven't used it, it's like a Bitmoji style map that shows you where your friends are and does a bunch of fun things. Like, you know, if your friend's at the airport, their avatar will be holding luggage. And if they're in a boat, their avatar will be in a boat. And so I joined there and really just enjoyed like kind of messing around with stuff. Like I worked on, you know, real production projects, but some of the favorite things that I did are like, they let me ship this thing where when you tap on somebody's Bitmoji and they're in a place where it's raining, it'll like rain down on the screen. There's a little particle effect, or it'll snow. And so like I had a ton of fun just building these random whimsical little things into the product. And after a while I was like, this is actually what I want to do. And so I transitioned away from this role as a production engineer to more of a prototyper, and I started working really closely with the design team at Snap. It was basically super high fidelity prototyping, so designers would have mocks or they would just have ideas, and you would start by taking the actual like iOS code base and we would fork it, and then we would just hack those features into the build, and they would put out like a special build for the product team and the designers that just had really hacky versions of all of these ideas that people were working on. Because with something like Snap, you're dealing with, you know, interpersonal communication, and so it's really hard to mock up. Like, it's really hard to tell in a design, like, oh, are you actually going to reach for this feature when you're sending somebody a Snap when you're, you know, out for drinks on a Friday night? And so really the only way to tell with a lot of these things is to build it for real and have people actually use them and be able to actually communicate with their friends who work at the company and really feel it out.
It's interesting because I was just talking with Gavin Nelson. He's now working on the Linear mobile app. And he was explaining how like so much of the design is the interaction in what he's working on, you know? And like when a design is the interaction, it's only so far you can push it in Figma. Like you got to just get into Swift UI or whatever and make a thing and be able to like ship, like send out a preview build. So there's definitely a theme that I'm catching on to here at these companies.
Yeah, I mean, we have a saying at Arc, like you can't just think really hard and design a browser because the web is so messy and the way people use the web is so, so messy that you can try as hard as you want to mock something up in Figma, but you're never going to know until it's built and you can actually use it day to day.
Okay, so then let's make the jump. So how did you go from engineer at Snap, never having had a like traditional design role, to becoming the founding designer at the Browser Company?
I mean, I have no idea why Josh and Hirsch took a chance on me, honestly. Maybe it was my website, because it's kind of fun. I don't know. But the story is, I'd actually been really interested in browsers for a really long time. Ever since college, I saw people make fancy email apps and fancy notes apps. And I was always like, why is nobody making a fancy browser? Like, this is a tool that I use way more than any of those other tools. Like, why is nobody making the like mailbox of web browsers? And so in my spare time, I was actually like prototyping a web browser on my own. And I was doing it in Swift UI in like 2019 when Swift UI had just come out, and it was terrible and really rough. But I had like a really basic sidebar and like you could load pages, and it was totally unusable. But I was excited about the idea, and I had friends who like knew I was into web browsers, and occasionally I would hear from them, oh, like there's this VC guy who's starting a browser company, you should talk to him. And eventually I did. He said Josh invited me to get breakfast, and we chatted, and he seemed cool. But what really sold me on wanting to actually work there was Josh. We were talking about the browser that I had made, and he was talking about the browser that they were working on. And he's like, oh, you have a sidebar in yours. Well, what side is your sidebar on? And I was like, well, it's on the left. Duh, like that's where sidebars go. And Josh was like, well, actually ours is on the right because we've thought about this a ton. And web apps put their sidebars on the left. And so you want to balance it and you want to put your sidebar on the right. And he was wrong in retrospect. But I was like, oh, wow, like you could think about this all day. Like this is a really deep problem. And like, I'm doing this in my spare time. I'm not engaging at this level, but I could. And so I was like that was the moment where I was like, no, this would be a really interesting thing to dig into.
I love that, like knowing where you actually ship now, because it is in fact on the left. So at some point you definitely won that argument.
Well, I mean, I don't have a smart opinion. We've tried it and it's actually really interesting. The thing you notice when you put the sidebar on the right is that you just spend a lot of time moving your mouse across the middle of the screen. And you like notice it. You're like, I am spending a lot of time dragging my mouse across too many pixels. Like it just like the little nitty gritty details of like how you interact with something really, really show up with a tool like the browser that you're using all the time. But that's kind of where we ended up. But to continue the story of how I got there. So I met with Josh. I was excited about the project. They had me do a couple really short interviews, and then they were basically like, you're hired. And I wasn't sure if I was going to take it. And I met with Josh, and I think, and I was like, I don't know any of these people. I didn't know Josh. I didn't know Hirsch. I didn't know Samir, who was the founding engineer. But I just got to know them, and I sort of realized, yeah, they're good people. I should work with these people. Josh told me about his time at the White House and how proud he was about like running a baby diaper distribution program. And I was like, this seems like a good guy. And I feel like now is the time in my life to take a chance on an ambitious startup. And so I did, like 2 months before COVID, I joined, and it was the Browser Company of New York, and we were going to be totally in person and work in the office every day. And that didn't really work out, but you know, the rest of the company sort of did.
All right, so then let's talk about the early days, because I think it's like one of the more unique environments to inherit as a designer, where, you know, you're not really responding to this clear set of problem statements. You just have this belief that browsing can be better. And not only that, the browser is a massive piece of software, so you can't build like an MVP. Like, what's an MVP of the browser, you know? So given that starting line, what do those first few months look like as the first designer?
I mean, it was a lot of just, we were prototyping, we were trying to build MVPs, and we knew we couldn't build an MVP for the world, but we could build an MVP for ourselves, and we could put in all of the features that we needed to use a browser day to day, even though we knew it was going to be bad and it was going to be missing a ton of things. And so we started off, when I had joined, the way they had been working was they were going to do a different prototype each week or each 2 weeks or something like that. And they would just name them and they would iterate. And so like 1 week we'd be doing a prototype where there was a sidebar on the left or a sidebar on the right. The first one I worked on was this hierarchical tab system where you had, when you opened one tab, it would be nested underneath its parent tab, which was kind of cool, but not that useful ultimately. And we just did a ton of these. Like we had versions where you could switch spaces and versions where you could have tabs at the top, but there were only 5 of them. And we just like really rapidly iterated and tried to see like, okay, you know, what, like we kind of had no shortage of ideas. We just needed a really fast process to try them. And so Hirsch and Samir built this foundation of a browser they could iterate on in Electron. It was horrendously slow. It was not very reliable, but you could get a sense of like, you could put tabs wherever you wanted them. You could put the command bar wherever you wanted it. You could add various different screens really easily. And so you could really get a sense of what was useful and what wasn't. And so we spent like 6 months trying stuff, and the vast majority of it did not work out at all. But we were like, cool, we still had like a ton of ideas and a ton of like excitement and you know, it was COVID, so we had nothing else to do. And eventually we hit on a couple ideas that we kind of liked. And so we took those and formed that into the first version of Arc.
Can you talk a little bit about the role of external user feedback in the early stages? Like, how much even was that a thing? Because, you know, I don't know, I've never seen someone like complain about their browser, really. Like, historically, we haven't cared that much about the browser. And so talk to me a little bit about this balance between feedback and then just exploring and trusting your gut.
In the early stages, we were kind of lucky in that we were building for ourselves, you know, people who spent a lot of time in the browser, reasonably tech savvy, but not everyone engineers. And so we were kind of lucky in that if we built something, it was pretty obvious to ourselves whether it was useful or not. You know, you can try to build a feature into the browser and use it day to day, but you know, you have to use this tool for work. And so you can't really kid yourself about what works and what doesn't. And so we actually had, I think, our superpower in the first 6 months or so was that we were the audience and we were the daily users and we were using this tool and we were fully dependent on it for so much that like we didn't really need to do user research or focus grouping or anything like that. We would hear from ourselves and from folks on the team. And later, you know, of course, we branched out. We've gotten a lot better at doing UX research and expanding and getting the perspectives of people outside our team. But in the very early days, it was very much just like, we are the customer.
You know, something else that's unique about Arc and really has been since even like the beta is, you know, you obviously sweat the details, but it's more than that. Like there's a soul and a personality that you can feel in the product and, you know, elements that maybe a lot of other product teams would view as unnecessary, something like the onboarding cards that you had, you know? So can you talk to us a little bit about how the visual language for Arc came to be?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you mentioned the onboarding screen, because that was one of the first projects. Once we had a couple other designers on the team, Carla Cole and Christina Warshavska, they joined, and Omar Elfenek, and they built this incredible onboarding screen. And this is the first big project that I was like kind of not involved in. And it's funny, I think that Josh hired me because I was at Snap, and he's like, oh, you're going to make all these cool, whimsical things for the browser. And I was coming in, and I was like, this is my first design job, and this is a serious piece of software, so I have to make this really efficient and usable. And I kind of just like didn't think about the feeling very much for the first year or so of my time there. And so I think Josh, at a certain point, was like, we're going to give this project to other people who can actually do this stuff. And eventually, I sort of, you know, came around and was like, actually, you know, it's not all about the utility. But, you know, I was like shown this firsthand. You know, we built this onboarding flow, which is just a series of forms at the end of the day. And we got people raving about it on Twitter, and people would open it up and start the onboarding process and go, whoa, in a way that like you very rarely hear people go, whoa, when they look at something on their computer screen. And so to me, the lesson was very much like, you have to make people feel something, you have to make people excited. And there's not really a lot of places where it's wrong to do that. And it doesn't even matter so much like what the actual identity is. I think as a team, we've kind of coalesced around like, what is our vibe? What are the feelings we want to evoke? But I think really it comes from the people who worked on that project, who just like had this idea of what they wanted to build, and they brought it to life, and it evoked a feeling. It's almost like kind of like, you know, like art, where it's like there's no right answer for what it should be. Make people feel something.
It reminds me of something else you said to me, which is people at Arc leave their fingerprints on the things that they ship. So maybe we could zoom in on that period of time where you're kind of coming to this idea where it's like, okay, I want to actually inject more feeling and go beyond utility. What is an example of something where you designed it and you're like, yeah, like I can see my fingerprints on this feature or this interaction?
Yeah, I think a good one is the first version of our mobile app. So we've had two mobile apps. Arc Search is the most recent one. It's like a full-fledged browser. And before that, we had this companion app, which just showed you your tabs from your sidebar. You could add things to it. And it was very much just like a stopgap solution before we could build out a real mobile browser. But what was cool about it is because it was basically just like a list view and a share extension, there was so much room to like really add a bunch of detail and a bunch of joy to it. And so I spent like a lot of time going really deep on what I would make a mobile app look like if I wasn't using the system UI kit or really borrowing from anyone, and landed on this really fun skeuomorphic design with like a bunch of, you know, gradients and bright colors and soft text labels. And I think I spent like 3 or 4 days on this one like button component that you'd use when you wanted to add something to your sidebar or also to sign in, where it was like this big 3D thing and you push down on it and it would animate down. And there'd be two haptics, one for when you push down and one for when you push up, and a bunch of shadows and all this crazy stuff. And I built that all in Swift UI. And it was very much, for me, it was just like kind of self-indulgent. It was like a good time. But I think that's kind of what that's how you get the best work out of a team like this, is like people go off and they do what they're inspired to do and they leave their own fingerprints on it. And if you empower people to do that and you don't let them get too far afield, I think you wind up with just like labors of love. I put a lot of like labors of love into that app, and hopefully it's shown through.
It's cool to hear you say labor of love, because as someone who just kind of is observing from Twitter, something that really stands out to me about Arc and just the way that you celebrate labors of love is every single release cites the specific designers and engineers that worked on that thing. And you can see how this like flywheel of soul just keeps spinning, where you're like really incentivized to make something awesome because you know your name's going to be put on it. And how many designers get their name put on a feature that's released at a big company today?
Yeah, very few. I think that, I mean, it's funny because I think a lot of the like best practice for a design team is like the team should behave as one. There should be this very cohesive design system. Everyone should be producing work that is extremely consistent, that looks the same, that feels the same, that has the same voice. And I don't know whether that's right or wrong, but I know I've really enjoyed being in a team that kind of bucks that trend, for better or worse. I don't think this is a deliberate thing. I don't know if, you know, Dustin, our design lead, would say like he's like tried to foster this environment. But I think through deliberate actions and non-deliberate actions, we've kind of wound up in this place where it's like, you know, everyone does have a fingerprint. There is kind of an editorial voice. I don't know much about filmmaking, but like everyone at Browser Co. likes to talk about A24. And one of the things that I've been told is very special about A24 is that they let the filmmakers, they give them an enormous amount of creative freedom. They're not like other studios where they're like, you know, there's a bunch of people in a room being like, here's how we can make a marketable film. They give filmmakers with a very strong voice a lot of freedom, just go out and do what they want. And that's how they wind up with the kind of stuff they put out. And Browser Company in a way feels a lot like that, where it's like, yeah, you have a company and you do have a brand and a voice that we all share, but there's individual craftspeople with individual voices who are being allowed to shine through.
Can we talk a little bit more about your personal process? Like once you have your eyes set on some kind of an opportunity, like what are you doing to push that forward and figure out what something can become? And how does your engineering background play into that too?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on what the project is, but a lot of the time, the first thing I do is just open up Xcode and try something out, particularly with you know, some of the recent AI stuff we've been doing, where so much of what, you know, the feeling of something depends on the feeling you're going to get back from a language model or something like that, or the kind of data you'll get back from the web. And so a lot of my process really is just starting with prototypes at a very functional level, and often they'll be like really rough and they won't have the feelings or the vibe that you would expect, or the usability, but I'll start just like trying to get a product I can live on as quickly as possible. And so a lot of my work recently has been in just kind of continuing what I did at Snap, where we had a separate build of the app that people were just living on day to day, but was very easy for designers to iterate on. So now we have this, we have a version of Arc, and we have a lot of prototypes that are like hacked directly into Arc behind feature flags. And then we have various other prototype browsers that other folks on the team have built that are just recreations of a basic browser where you can feel out various different features or various different UIs or changes. And so a lot of it is just like based around this idea that like, you can't think really hard, you can't spend too much time in Figma, just get something functional in front of you.
I source some questions from Twitter. And View from Coinbase had one that really resonated with me, which kind of gets at this feeling that I think a lot of designers have, where there's this tension between capitalizing on what is familiar versus, you know, we all have this desire to create something that is novel and the world hasn't seen before. And a lot of the patterns that you're shipping, I do believe, are quite innovative. And also, you're designing for a surface that really hasn't changed in decades. So how do you, as a designer, go past just building something that is like functional and really identify ways to raise the ceiling for what a given feature or interaction can be?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing is you have to decide whether you should do that. I think there's a lot of places in a product where you should, where it's perfectly reasonable to say, I am going to do exactly what the user expects here. We talk about this a lot, like what's our novelty budget in a product? How much are we willing to make people encounter something new? And are we doing that for the right things? So an example of that would be, you know, in Arc Search, we have like an incognito mode, and it doesn't work like normal incognito modes where you like, you kind of go into the tab switcher and switch your whole browser to incognito. We put a little button in the search box where you can toggle on or off incognito, because the idea is the moment you realize you want to be incognito is when you're doing a search and you want to be like, hey, what's this thing on my foot growing? And it's like, at that moment, you're like, oh, I need to be in incognito. And so, of course, we're going to put the entry point in the search box. And I'm actually not sure if that was the right decision in retrospect. There's a lot of people who are like, oh, I couldn't figure out incognito, or I don't know what this weird icon is. And we spent a long time trying to find an icon that means not incognito, but not in a creepy way. And so it's like, you really have to be very deliberate about when you actually want to change something and whether you have a good reason for it. And then once you do it, I mean, really, it just comes down to like being generative and like taking the wildest ideas and giving them the time of day. We've never really had a problem with having ideas at BrowserCo. I think we just have a lot of folks in the team who have a lot of ideas. And, you know, we listen to people on Twitter and various other places who like tell us their ideas, and people will often, you know, suggest quite good ideas. And so we haven't really ever had a problem with that. When you're using a tool every day and living in it, it becomes obvious what the pain points are and when things could be better. So I think it really is just for us a prioritization thing of like, what should we actually do differently?
I mean, it's definitely clear as an outsider that you do have a lot of ideas, because I see a lot of prototypes floating out in the wild and, you know, maybe Twitter or Reddit or wherever. I would imagine that you have a pretty extensive graveyard of prototypes as a result of all of these ideas. So what has to happen for the team to look at a prototype and get to the point where they're just like, yeah, like this has to get into the product?
Even with a team like ours that is like very motivated to try our own stuff, you know, because it is a browser, like it can be pretty clear when you put something in the product and it's not useful that it's fine and we don't need to ship it. One thing we will do sometimes is we'll have something in the internal browser behind a feature flag, and we'll just kind of turn it off for people and see if anyone notices. And if nobody notices, then we're like, great, that means that this was not an important part of the experience, and it's not worth shipping. Our bar has raised and lowered at various points for like how much we want to really blow ourselves away before we ship something.
Is there an example where the bar was really high, where you just like, you did kind of want to blow yourself away before releasing something to the public?
One is the AI product that we worked on a while back. We built like 20 or 30 prototypes internally, and we had like a whole idea for the kind of problem we wanted to solve, because we were just playing around with this Play-Doh, and we said, hey, you know, we're going to go into this project. We know that we have this new technology available for us. Let's build something new, and let's kind of go out and try to find problems to solve, which in most cases I think is a pretty bad thing to do. But when you have a brand new technology that can solve a lot of problems and you feel conviction around it, I don't think it's a terrible idea to go around and say, like, I have this hammer, let me go find some nails. And so we had one idea that we really, really wanted to nail, which was this idea of like, let's help you discover more websites. You're on a website, let's show you something related to that that's really interesting and engaging. Almost like, you know, the TikTok, like how you swipe down on TikTok and you find something that's new and exciting every time you do it. And we like pushed on this for a long time. We tried like 20 or 30 ideas. And eventually at the end of the day, we were kind of like, yeah, you know, we put some in the build and we used them occasionally, and we were kind of enthused when we used them. But at the end of the day, we were like, hey, you know we really love this idea and this direction, but like we just can't ship anything like this that doesn't feel like it is wildly meeting our own needs as people. Like, it doesn't feel like it really has a reason to exist. And so we actually like totally went back to the drawing board and said, okay, what are other things we can use this technology for? And we landed on something totally different, which was like really small interactions in tiny parts of the product. Like you pin a tab and we take the name and we tidy it up a little bit, or you're using Command F to find something and you can't find it. And so we say, hey, you want to ask a language model if they can find what you're looking for in this document. So like really, really small incremental things. And we use those and we're like, yeah, these feel like they're powering up our experience in a way that like is very much warranted. And so that's typically how a lot of our explorations will go. We'll like try a bunch of stuff. We'll really be interested in a theme like discovery on the internet, and we'll push on it really hard, but you can't force it. And I think we've done a fairly good job in the past of not forcing it in a lot of areas. So hopefully we continue that.
I very much so agree, for what it's worth. Like, I think that when the AI explosion first started, everyone was slapping on a chatbot everywhere you turned, you know? And you were kind of almost expecting you all to do the same. And there was like this pretty significant delay. Like, you were very much so a second mover. And then when you did release, it felt fresh because it wasn't very open-ended. You had these very pointed ways of introducing the AI to solve like very specific problems, which I think was a pretty unique entry point in the broader landscape.
Yeah, we tried to like take what we learned from everyone else's product and work it in a useful way. But it was very much just the product of like 10,000 wide explorations.
Can we talk a little bit more about the explorations then? Because you keep bringing us back to this idea that like there's no shortage of ideas. What can we learn from your own ideation process? Like, how are you as a designer generating ideas and identifying the right problems to solve or opportunities to explore?
That's a good question. I mean, I think to me, I've never been like much of an ideator. Like, I don't think I'm very productive when I like try to make a bunch of post-its or make a big list of ideas. There's two things I do. The first is I just like try to increase my like idea surface area. Like, I just try to like do a bunch of stuff that I think will help me generate ideas randomly in the moment. And so a lot of what I do is just like fucking around and doing like random projects in the hopes that some of those will like eventually turn into useful and valuable ideas. And so one big example of that is, I think this was like maybe in March of last year, I was playing around with the OpenAI API. And I had this idea for, I realized that you could ask it to output HTML. And so I had this idea of like, oh, what if I made a little web browser in SwiftUI on my phone where I could type in a URL? And I just, rather than fetching it and displaying the HTML, I just asked a model to like kind of hallucinate the HTML. And so you could type in Nate Parrott's cool website where I sell knickknacks, and it would just generate a plausible web page for it. And I, of course, in the prompt, I was like, you know, make it feel like a GeoCities retro website, use a bunch of marquee tags and stuff like that. And it was this really fun thing where it's like, I built this little parallel web for myself and had a lot of fun doing it. And of course, I wasn't thinking about like, oh, this is going to like turn into a browser company product. But it's funny because then about 8 months later, we were thinking about this mobile app, and I was like thinking about ideas for what to prototype for like what would be the hook feature. And I was like, hey, that thing where I asked the computer to make a website was kind of cool. What if I could ask the computer to make a website, but I gave it some web data so that it wasn't just making it up? And that's what kind of was the original spark for the idea behind Browse for Me, which is our kind of like AI search summary feature, where like the early prototypes, it was literally making a website and writing its own HTML. And now it doesn't do that. But this like core idea of like the computer can make you a web page personalized to exactly what you typed, like came out of that. And so I think one of the best things you can do is just like follow your own curiosity and play around and like immerse yourself in the space and immerse yourself in what's possible and what's fun and what feels good. And then when it comes time to like get down to business and like build real stuff people want, like you'll have a lot more ideas.
It's interesting that Browse for Me, which, you know, is many people's favorite feature now, I use it so many times a day. It came out of you knowing what is possible with LLMs and tinkering more at like the technical layer rather than exploring UI and Figma.
Yeah, I really like that. And I've actually been really interested recently in like what we can do to make that more accessible to more designers, because, you know, I think I have a pretty technical background for a designer. And so I was able to like jump into these tools and really feel it out. But there's so much you can do with generative UI and asking LLMs to output more than just like walls of text. And I think a lot of what we've been successful with the browser company so far is like we're pretty good at that. But there's not really a good design tool that lets you immerse yourself in it without coding. So hopefully soon.
Hopefully soon. I'm a big believer. How has your thinking evolved in terms of the best ways to create interfaces to help users interact with AI?
So I very much buy into this idea that more of our tools should almost feel like e-bikes, where it's like you are doing the thing and the computer is providing an assist to make you a little bit more powerful. And so like I'm a big fan of GitHub Copilot and products that feel like that. But as I've started building more of these things, the more I've actually been interested in this idea of anthropomorphizing the tools and that being a useful way to interact with them. I think as a profession, I think designers really don't want to anthropomorphize LLMs. They want to treat them as like machines that generate UI for you, or like assistants that are specifically like do not have a personality and are like kind of omniscient and just like reflections of the software. And it's like, that's great and that's fine. But I actually think that putting like a name and a face and a set of personality traits on one of these language models actually is a great way to surface like what they do and how they behave, and to remind people that they're fallible. They're not always right. They do have quirks. They do have things they're good at and they're bad at. And they have biases. Just like, you know, we're not used to like software having biases. And like now we have these LLMs, which are useful, but you have to remember they may not share your values. They may not be right. They may not be trustworthy. They may screw up. And I think, you know, putting a name and a face on it actually really, really helps with that.
We've kind of been orbiting around this idea of personality in design. And I want to go a little bit deeper. And I'm going to try something here. So let's say hypothetically, you are prototyping a new feature. You have something. It's functional. You can imagine yourself using it. It solves some kind of a problem or shortcoming in the existing product. And now you are embarking on this process to inject personality and soul and really make this thing come alive. What's your creative process look like to go from raw utility to something that is delightful?
A lot of it just comes down to like going out and finding your own inspiration. So like I have, you know, Figma boards that are just like 10,000 little things that I've found from across the web that I really enjoy that I've just collected here and I'm going to try, you know, borrowing inspiration from, or I'll build on the work of other designers on the team.
Can you talk a little bit more about your inspiration process? Like where are you sourcing inspiration?
It's very rough. So these days I will, let's see, I'll go through, sometimes I'll even go through Dribbble, which I know is super old school now, but I'll Google stuff and I'll be like, hey, you know, what do, you know, different onboarding flows look like? And I'll go back to, I have a couple apps that I feel like I touch on a lot that I'm very inspired by, like CoStar, the astrology app. I just love how it feels like so little like other apps. Zenly, which is not around anymore, but was this incredible location sharing tool that was acquired by Snap. And so like, I feel like I go back to those touchstones a lot and just try to see like what I can learn. One thing I'm very inspired by is, I'm going to totally forget the name of the person who did this talk, but you've probably seen it, about gaming and adding juice to video games. How, you know, in every single interaction in a video game, like, you know, there's the actual interaction happening and it's being reflected on screen. And then there's just like 20 layers of like joy and excitement that happen there. Like, you know, you'll have a sound and you'll have a bounce and a reverb and the screen will light up in a different color and the ball will pop a little bit. And so just like, I'm very inspired by stuff like that. Just like looking at like, what are the layers of detail on each of these things and how can I add my own little, like accrete like these layers of detail and fidelity on top of whatever it is I'm building.
Okay, let's go back into technical land here. So I want to learn a little bit about how you work with engineers on Arc. So maybe we could talk about Boosts for a second. What did collaboration look like on that project?
Yeah, Boosts was really fun because it was also like a very deeply technical project. You know, our idea was we wanted to let people kind of edit the web with guardrails and without knowing anything about how to code. The way it worked in the beginning actually was I was working with a designer named Patrick Moberg, who's this incredible prototyper, engineer, designer. And he was basically like, he just sort of screwed around in code for a couple weeks trying to figure out like what are really good primitives for editing the web. And so one of my favorite things he came up with was this idea of like find and replacing colors on a web page. Because like if you're trying to retheme a website, there's so many colors. As a human being, you can't possibly recolor every element. But what if you could do like a kind of fuzzy find and replace across the colors on a page? And he figured out how to implement this in a really like rough, hacky JavaScript way, where he iterated over all the elements and looked at their colors. You know, it was not very efficient. And so when we sat down and we wanted to actually build this feature, I sat down with the engineering production team, which was a couple folks, Darren Fisher, who was one of the early folks on Chrome, and then Victoria Kirst, who also worked on Chrome and a bunch of like very deeply technical parts of the project. And I said, hey, you know, Patrick built this really hacky color replacement thing. Can you figure out how to make it work for real and make it work well? We sat down and Darren like actually went into the Chromium code, and we were talking over video call, and he was going into the Chromium code and trying to figure out if there was a way where he could do this, and he couldn't figure it out. And so eventually he comes back to me and he's like, you know, Nate, we can't actually do this. What if instead you could apply these various color filters? And he came back with this whole other system of like, you know, here's what Chromium will let you do. And then I went off on my own and I tried to do a little prototype of like, can I retheme a website using these controls that Darren has given me? And I was prototyping and building on top of Patrick's stuff. And I came back and I realized I could do it. And so I went back to Darren and I was like, great, we can do this. And so he went off and implemented it. Meanwhile, he's also implementing all the UI and everything like that. And so in that particular project, I mean, because it was such like an interdisciplinary thing where we were kind of building a design tool, but we were doing it like, you know, deeply within the bowels of Chromium. So it was very much a lot of like me and Darren and Victoria talking back and forth pretty frequently, and I going off and doing prototypes and handing them code and them telling me this code is not efficient and we can't implement it, or this won't actually work in these cases, and me going back and trying to figure out how to do it better and them providing ideas and suggestions. And so it was almost like not design and just collaboration as much as like, you know, they were the engineers in charge of one part and I was kind of like an engineer operating at a different level than them. We were exchanging code samples and just like mocks and designs and all sorts of artifacts. And it was very, very kind of ad hoc. A decent amount. Typically my process will be, I'll start off like, I can't sketch and draw on paper. I wish I could. If I did that, I would probably spend a lot more time doing that. But so I'll like do wireframes and rough mocks in Figma and then jump into code to see if we can actually like implement them and make them work well. And then jump back into Figma to try to iterate and see what looks good visually. So I would say it's about 50-50 right now. For interaction questions, I'll do it in code. For visual questions, I'll do it in Figma. When I want to go really wide, I'll do it in Figma, and then I'll write a bunch of little sticky notes on there talking about how the interactions might work. So I'd say it's about 50-50.
Okay, I was curious because now that the team has grown, I would imagine you're doing more collaborating with other designers who maybe don't have similar engineering backgrounds. And so I was wondering if maybe you were even being pulled a little bit more into Figma as of late.
I mean, not really. I think that one of the things that we've done really well as a company, you know, back to your point on like everyone having their own fingerprints, is that a lot of designers on the team have their own way of working, and a lot of engineers on the team have their own way of working. And so, you know, often we will do very traditional, like somebody will make a mock and they will hand it off to an engineer, and then they will, you know, annotate the implementation in Figma and be like, hey, please change these things. And often somebody will go to an engineer and be like, hey, I trust your product sense to do a first pass on this. Do it and let's just talk about it, all the way up to somebody who is technical, who is a designer, like just going into the code and making the changes, because it's a little quicker to do that than to do the back and forth. So it's like, it's very, very fluid. We do hand off the traditional way. We do hand off like in very non-traditional ways. But I think it's like the nice thing about being on this team is that everyone's role is super, super fluid.
Makes me want to ask another question then, because, you know, again, this is your first traditional design role. I would imagine you're doing lots of things for the first time. And now all of a sudden you're surrounded by, I mean, really, really incredible designers who I guess are all kind of to an extent doing things their own way. So what's something that you've noticed in the way that another designer is working where you're like, I like that. I'd like to incorporate that into my own practice.
We have this one designer on the team, Carla Cole, who was previously at Facebook. And what I've really, really admired about her is the way that she just steps out of like tech whenever she starts a project. So like she does a lot of our brand stuff, but also does a lot of our product design. And she's like the best person on our team in terms of like bringing feeling into a product. And the way she does it is like, she will find a vision board or create a vision board of like 10 different like vibes that a product could have. And then tons of examples across culture, across, you know, movies, across TV, across fashion, across art, of like things that all kind of connect with a particular common thread. And then she'll find the way that that common thread shows up in software. In a way that's really, really cool. And so, like, I aspire to be the person who knows about, you know, fashion and filmmaking and culture and all this stuff. And I don't know very much about it. But, like, that's an area where I'm, like, very much, like, that to me feels like the right way to do a lot of the stuff is to, like, forget about tech for a bit and go off and experience the world that people have created.
I'm nodding my head in agreement because I think I have a pretty similar experience where like I was a more technical founding designer. We brought in someone else, Yuan Wang, who was coming from Airbnb, who was like so much more skilled in that area. And I remember the first time she brought in like a mood board and it had like billboards from New York subway posters. And I'm like, whoa, I would never have done that. But it ended up influencing this entire visual direction that we went for this project. And I'll never forget that moment of like, wow, that is way outside of my traditional operating box as a designer.
It's funny too, to connect back to AI, it's like, I feel like we live in this era now where it's like, we have technology to do stuff that people in culture have been dreaming about and thinking about and envisioning for years and years and years. And it's like, there's, you know, of course there's the movie Her, and then there's like a million other things. And it's funny because like, we have like this enormous backlog of culture that can now be turned into software, and the lessons that they've learned in these invented worlds can be applied back to what we do.
Yeah, you know, I relate also to your inability to sketch. Like, I can't sketch. I never sketch. I can't draw anything. I'm jealous of the people that can. But now all of a sudden, these generative tools are encouraging me to pay more attention, basically, to art direction. Because all of a sudden, I kind of have the ability to hack art direction in a way that previously I would have been 100% reliant on someone else for.
Yeah, I haven't done a ton of it. I've always found the like generative art tools kind of like a little bit like I don't really feel like I'm in control as much as I would like to, but still very much like I would love to go and learn how to draw the old fashioned way. And if an AI can give me tips on how to do that, it's something I would love.
Hey guys, real quick, if you know me, then you know I love products. So I want to take just 30 seconds to tell you about three of my favorites. Now, anytime that I'm designing and building a website, you better believe that I'm going to use Framer. I made the switch recently and I'm never going back. Now, once it's time to animate my designs and showcase my work, that's when I'm going to use Jitter. It's like Figma, only for motion design. And every step of the way, I'm gonna be using Raycast constantly. It's the cornerstone of how I use my computer and the way that I stay in flow while I work. Now, I hand selected Framer, Raycast, and Jitter to partner with me so that I could do these interviews full time. So if you wanna show them some love, it would mean a lot. Okay, now on to the rest of the episode. Another feature I wanna talk about is the split view, because man, you iterated on that a lot. So can you give us a behind the scenes of the process and how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, I mean, split view was one of the first features that we built in our like long journey through the desert, trying to find useful browser features to build. It was one of the first that we built that we actually really, really liked. And it's a pretty obvious feature. I don't think it's nothing particularly groundbreaking. But once we figured out like, oh, we want to have a split view, we realized that the actual mechanics for how to do a split view are really, really complicated. You can have, you know, a single tab that has two different panes in it. You can have the ability to have two different tabs selected and show them both on screen. You could have one tab that's kind of docked as a sidebar and then, you know, freely switch other tabs. And like, we had this problem of like, we all knew in our heads what we wanted, but we had to fill in the metaphor for how it actually worked and what the edge cases looked like. And so we started with one direction and we used it for a couple months and we were like, this is okay, but it feels really unintuitive. And so we tried another direction and we were like, this is great, but I feel like, you know, we made a lot of things better and a lot of things worse. And so Finally, we said, okay, we have to solve this metaphor thing once and for all. We're literally going to get out and like do like basic designer problem solving. We're going to like sketch out all of the use cases that we have and how they would work in each of the like three metaphors that you could use for split view. And then we're going to go and survey people and we're going to be like, how common are each of these use cases? And then we're going to pick which ones we're going to make work really well and which ones we're going to be okay with saying these aren't going to work great. And then we're just going to implement that in the product. And so it was like very methodical and very almost kind of data driven. But I think at the end of the day, what it enabled us to do is meet the most humans where they were and introduce the minimum amount of friction possible. And it was like very much like, I feel like we're very intuition driven or feelings driven at Browser Co. And this is an example of a case where we actually were able to get outside that and just like get down to brass tacks and be very analytical. And I think it worked out.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear the data story because one of the key phrases I had written down was how Josh said that you all optimized for feelings over numbers, which is so rare. Like you never hear a CEO say that.
My take on this has always been like the numbers are really important to tell you if you're kind of doing, if you're directionally correct. And user research is also very important on the other end to tell you if you're like kind of, if you're at all building something that resonates with people. But at the end of the day, I think you need a really strong opinion. You need really strong vision. Like what feeling do you want to evoke? What kind of product do you want to bring into the world? And you can use data and you can use user research to update your mental model of like what the world is like and what people want and what people need and how people feel and what they do. But at the end of the day, the decider has to be like the designer and their vision. And that's kind of how we've approached it so far.
In your journey through the desert, were there other prototypes that you personally really liked that you hope resurface in the future?
There were a bunch. One that I really enjoyed and one like kind of idea that we have a couple ideas that we like have come back to again and again and haven't been able to nail. One of them is multiplayer. We've like always been fascinated with this idea of like, what if there was a multiplayer browser? And everyone's like, cool, what if there was a multiplayer browser? And then you're like, okay, well, what would you want your multiplayer browser to do? And they're like, I don't know. That's kind of where we're at with that. But then the other one is like having a homepage, a home on the internet. This is an idea that has come around again and again in various products. I think back to like iGoogle when I was a kid, like you'd be able to like set up your own homepage on Google with widgets and various things. And of course, you know, the home screens and various OSs have like added and removed widgets like 16 times. But I've always been very interested in this idea of a browser that gives you a personal homepage that is built for you with the content or the media or just the feeling that you want to feel. So one of the prototypes we built at the very beginning was this like homepage idea where you could customize what you saw when you opened a new tab. You could just have a photo or you could have a clock or you could have a notepad or you could like have this huge like dashboard of data with like your emails and your calendar and all of your most recent tabs. And it felt really cool because it was really personal. And it was also just like a genuinely new space that you could spend time in. And it felt like, you know, the internet kind of has no center of gravity for a lot of people. And it felt like it kind of centered the internet in a way that you don't really see. So we tried that and we realized that the ideas and the vibe felt really good. The positioning in the product felt wrong. You know, you shouldn't put it on the new tab page because when you open a new tab, you want a new tab. You don't want to be shown a bunch of content. And so that felt wrong. But the like idea behind it feels right. And I hope at some point we can bring something like that back because it felt very special.
Before I let you go, I wanna ask a few more personal questions. One that I really like to ask a lot of people, and I'm particularly interested in your perspective. What's something that you personally believe about design that you think a lot of other designers might disagree with?
A lot of like people in like this era of design really lionize like people like Steve Jobs. And it's like, you could think that Steve Jobs made all of the technology that you really loved, but like it was people, there were people on the team, and like they as a company made a decision to not elevate any of those people besides him. And one of the things that I think that Browser Co., I've been, you know, really fortunate that Browser Co. has done is we've been really good at letting the individual designers speak up and have voices and, you know, come on podcasts and talk about what we've built and like have individual styles for what we built. And like, I can look at something that anyone on the team has created and kind of know who made it without even like having, you know, known, being told, like I can just tell. And I like that. And there's a lot of fields where that's like very, very normal. And there's, for some reason in design, it's not. And so it's not really the like status quo, but it's something that I very much value.
For what it's worth, I think a lot of companies are about to copy this style of working and showing the work, because I think you are seeing success for that reason. It's fresh. Can we talk a little bit about feed? Because, you know, I source these questions from Twitter, and man, it is quite apparent that a lot of people really like your RSS app.
I mean, it's funny, it comes back to, it touches actually on what I was saying about the homepage earlier, about people, you know, wanting to have a homepage in Arc. I feel very much like the internet does not have a center of gravity right now, and maybe the browser should add it, or maybe it's another app. And, you know, over like in the middle of COVID, I was like, I realized that I was like opening Instagram many, many times a day and just like kind of mindlessly scrolling and then quitting the app and being like, I don't even know what I just watched. Like, I feel like I was just like kind of like fed slop. It's like, I mean, there's a lot of great things on Instagram, but I feel like I wanted to be a little more in control over what I was seeing. And so I said, well, let me build a newsfeed for myself that I'm totally in control in, and I can tweak all the dials and I can control exactly what is put in. And I can, you know, mix news through RSS and Twitter with, you know, flashbacks of memories from my photo library and reminders when it's like contacts' birthdays, all the way up to like flashcards if I want to learn something new. And so the idea was basically like give myself a home on the internet that like brings me everything new that's happening in a way that I very much feel like I'm in control of my own media diet. So I built the app for myself, put it out there. People have been using it. People seem to enjoy it. It's so very much just like a passion project for myself. But this idea of what if the internet felt a little bit more like Instagram, in that you could follow things and you could build up a set of the internet that was pushed to you and brought to you each day in a way that you were very much like the boss of, is an idea that I think is really interesting.
Yeah, it's really compelling actually to hear you talk about it. Last question before you go. You're in this first design role, honestly, designing on a pretty big stage with a lot of really talented people on a product that so many people adore. When you reflect on your own journey over the last few years, what's a way that you think you've grown as a designer while working at Arc?
The first one, I think, is realizing that feeling does not just belong in apps like Snap. It belongs in apps like a browser and even like in the most boring things like forms. I've learned a lot about the value of really simple metaphors. I think early on as a designer, I was very much like trying to come up with like the perfect system for everything. And then I later realized that actually, no, you shouldn't try to come up with the perfect system for people. You should try to build really simple tools that people can understand and wield based on their own judgment for them to do whatever it is they need to do. It's really easy to want to like think really hard about something and really intellectualize something, but it's often much better to just kind of wade in and start doing something. And I think that one of the bigger lessons I've learned is that like just kind of start doing things. Get your body moving, get your pencils, your pixels flowing, get your cursor moving, and that's generally the way forward. Don't fret, just sketch.
I love it. I love ending on wade in as a challenge for anyone listening who's kind of just had this thing that they're considering but haven't started. Like, it's just start. I think it's great.
Yeah. Also, take the stupidest idea you can think of for a personal website and make that.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Thank you. I almost forgot. I will put it in the show notes. If you haven't been on Nate's personal site, you have to check it out. It is easily the most unique portfolio that I've seen on the internet, and definitely will extend the box of what you think of when you think of a personal website. So we will definitely put that in the show notes. Nate, this has been amazing, man. It's so great to hear your journey. Happy for you. You can even just hear in the way that you're talking that you're having a lot of fun. So I'm excited to see where you take this.
Yeah, wonderful chatting.
Hey, it's Rid. Don't forget, if you want to go even deeper, each week I send an email out to over 10,000 designers with bonus resources and key takeaways from these conversations. So head to dive.club/email to sign up. Okay, I'll see you next week.